Welcome to Fontanelle, the podcast with a soft spot for paediatrics. I'm Caroline Story, a paediatric trainee in Wessex, and I'm here today in the outpatients department of Poole Hospital, where Dr. Mark Tye works as a consultant paediatrician with an interest in gastro and oncology, and also as an associate editor for Archives of Disease in Childhood. And it's in this capacity, really, as an editor, that I'm talking to him today. He recently gave an enlightening talk at the Peer Conference 2018 called Writing Right, Preparing Publications to Succeed. And he's kindly agreed to meet up and talk through some of the main points today. So I started by asking Mark, when we as doctors are looking to get something published, what should we bear in mind?
So I think it's worth bearing in mind how people pick up education and useful articles. We all receive information through our BMJ or Archives of Disease in Childhood, and it hits the mat, and then we put it aside and we promise ourselves that we're going to read it. But actually carving out half an hour of formal time, either in work or at home, to do this is really difficult. There's an interesting Japanese word called tsundoku, which is the art of buying books and journals and never reading them and just stacking them in a pile of shame in the corner. It would be worth saying that people read material either in an emergency or on a case-by-case basis. They will read it on the bus or in competition with leisure time or important family activities, or oddly enough, on the loo, but I wasn't brave enough to put that on a slide. And that helps us to understand a topic area, but we will often look at the topic, look at the title and decide whether we're interested, look at the abstract and see whether it's got useful information. Mm-hmm. And then if it passes those two particular gates, then think about reading that article. And when we're thinking about writing an article, that would be if it's a really good way of knowing an area particularly well.
Mm. Yeah. So basically we are writing as a way of learning.
Yes. Writing through understanding and working with a team so that you can help adjust your message, make sure that it's evidence-based, and it will stay with you for the rest of your life.
Definitely.
So in thinking about producing your message and producing your article, it is worth looking, for example, at what articles have the best reading statistics out there. So for those people who don't know Archives of Disease in Childhood, there is the Blue Journal, which is the main print journal. Then there is Fetal and Neonatal, which is the red journal, which focuses on neonatal specific issues. And then there's Education in Practice, which aims to help have a slightly different style of article, less randomized controlled trials, for example, but more to help clinicians improve their practical paediatric day-to-day work at the coalface. Mm-hmm. So when you look at, for example, what works in archives, in the main Blue Journal, if you look in 2018, the biggest impacting articles were myths, facts and controversies in management of anaphylaxis. There was a study looking at restrictive fluid boluses in early septic shock and maternal immunisation in pregnancy. When you're looking at Fetal and Neonatal edition, the things that made a difference were a discussion about corticosteroids for the prevention of bronchopulmonary dysplasia. There was an article on updated birth weight centiles for England and Wales, and also early postnatal growth failure in preterm infants, which was actually a Wessex-generated article with Ed Andrews and Mark Johnson and Mark Beattie.
And that's what they actually presented at the conference this week.
They presented that at this conference. And it's already, for example, got over 3,000 downloads off the archives website.
And can you see any trends in these, the most popular or the most downloaded articles? Is there anything that stands out?
Yeah, I think it's about it's about providing good evidence in a concise way on topics that paediatricians want and neonatologists want to read about.
Mm-hmm.
Not being too abstract or not being too niche, but thinking about what the vast majority of your colleagues are dealing with on a daily basis.
Yeah, okay, great. I think you were also talking about the motivation for becoming a medical author as well. Could you just share about that?
I mean, it is exciting, but the things to bear in mind when you start writing an article is because it will help you improve patient care, and it's part of our duties of a doctor as laid down by the GMC, but it definitely helps us understand the subject area better and to understand how people put papers together. It also helps in future employment, and there's some really good evidence actually coming through from the CQC that colleagues who are interested in writing are interested in improving quality and therefore provide quality care for their patients and definitely have better metrics.
Okay, and I think it's something that we probably all think we should do. I guess it's a question of how we get to the point of actually doing it, and who asks us to join them and who asks us to,
yes.
and what we get asked to do. And I mean, I was asked to write a case study about an orthopaedic hip replacement online follow-up tool, which I did.
Yes. And I think that's that really, you know, I think that's mainly, that's how many of us get involved when somebody points at us and says, this would be really interesting to write up, and you don't step back quick enough, or you smile and nod nicely. And that is definitely the right way to start, but it is worth thinking about a case study and knowing in terms of the statistics that less than 3% of them will get published if you follow it all the way through and keep it in a case report format. There are now much more robust ways of managing a interesting case that you want to publish. And if you get it into the right format, you're much more likely to translate that into print.
That sounds good. So could you just tell us about some of these formats?
Yes. First, in terms of kind of setting out on this journey, it's worth making sure that you've got the right team with you.
Yeah. Okay.
So you've got to have a team with you that has previous publications, that are accessible, that write clearly, and you like the messages that they are putting out as a team.
Mm.
They have to have that ability to look at drafts and send them back in a timely way, but also to preserve that independent voice. They're not just nodding along with what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
They can challenge you and help augment what you're trying to say. Always keep the message that you're trying to keep really clear. So it's got to fill a gap in the medical literature, and it's got to say something interesting that's not necessarily been noted before. It's important when you're thinking about your team, try and avoid meaningless middle authors. But if there are colleagues who have been involved in a patient's care, do involve them, because it's professionally nice and you're going to be working with them for the next 30, 40 years. If you are worried or wonder whether somebody fulfills the criteria to be an author, then always have a look at the International Consensus of Medical Journal Editors recommendations, which came out in 2013, and they say authorship should be based on substantial contribution to either the conception or design of the work, or they've really helped with acquiring and analysing or interpreting the data. They should also have been part of drafting the work and providing some important intellectual contribution to it, and have approved the final article and have agreed to be accountable for the work. So one example was, for example, the article on the MMR vaccine. There were, once the article ran into trouble, there were at least two or three authors who stepped back and said, actually, I didn't know about this article, and they had just been added on as authors.
And that must happen quite a lot. I mean, if that article hadn't got into trouble, presumably they would have been
stayed on it. Yes, through not voicing their concerns.
Yeah.
Yes. So in terms of the actual vehicles for your message, for example, Archives of Disease in Childhood have a couple of fun formats that really need to be shaped according to what you're trying to say. In terms of thinking about it, so images, for example, is 250 words, maximum of, you know, 4 or 5 references, and all it needs is a punchy picture carrying the message that you're saying, a paragraph outlining the patient's history, a paragraph outlining the important learning gems that you want a reader to take away, and then a little bit of a patient conclusion so you know what happened to the patient. Mm-hmm. That should probably only take 6 weeks to 2 months to write up, and hopefully should be relatively quick when balanced with, you know, other competing interests that pediatric trainees have, for example, writing masters, you know, out of hours work, and also running family lives and things like that.
And what type of images do you think are the best?
So in terms of images, clinical images are great. And if you're not sure whether a patient's image is, you know, it is useful, just go to Google Images and look for images in the same subject. If you get an entire page worth of in exactly identical clinical images, then it probably isn't that novel. However, if it's new and or if the picture is really good, then that's a particularly standout feature. So definitely get patient consent and to publish very early on, and you may want to think about whether medical photography is better at taking photos and has less ethical constraints than if you take it on your phone and keep it on your phone. It's got to be something that's really easy to see for the general paediatrician, and bear in mind that when you put it in print, you'll probably lose a little bit of clarity. So for example, chest x-rays, abdominal x-rays, we probably look at quite a lot. CT heads, MRI, if it's really clear, then it'll be good. Particularly 3D CT, you know, usually makes the you know, has significant visual impact. Ultrasounds are very user dependent, and similarly echoes, so it's got to be pretty startling to get through as an ultrasound on its own. But if you can add in together, so a clinical image plus a radiological image would be stronger than just a clinical image on its own. And that would be the point that, for example, having radiology involved would be useful in making sure that your legends are appropriate for the message that you're trying to say.
I think your point about using medical photography is a really good one, because we often see something interesting, and I tend to end up asking parents to take a picture on their phone.
Yes.
Because then we could potentially access that later, but I'm not getting into bother on my own. But I think we could definitely make more use of medical photography in general.
Yes. And the thing is, with the other thing to say is that with images or with other vehicles within archives, because these things are relatively unique, they'll be really easy to identify. So if you don't have patient consent, it is very difficult for any journal to proceed to publish it, even if the patient has moved away or child has passed away or something like that. Consent is a prerequisite. Other vehicles that you can use for your publication, if it's not quite so novel, is something called Epilogue, which is in the green version, so of Archives of Disease in Childhood.
And remind me what the green version is.
So is Education and Practice.
Yep. Okay.
So a good epilogue, 600 words. It's got should have a punchy title with a clear, relevant message, and again, is aimed to help a colleague, for example, on a ward round, who is confronted with this clinical situation.
Yeah.
References, again, 4 to 5, but it should be a reasonably common clinical scenario with a good clinical image and and if you've got it, a radiological image, and MCQs to help the clinician put themselves in the place, you know, in the place of the, you know, theoretical clinician on the ward round, and then with each MCQ have a paragraph or two highlighting the salient points, the and it should be reasonably novel. So you don't want necessarily an MCQ that you might have faced during membership,
no.
For example. You want something with up-to-date clinical information, for example, you know, novel management of status epilepticus, for example, or up-to-date management of sepsis, to help get the clinician into the clinical scenario and then to help build on their knowledge and just take out an extra two or three learning points that they can take away and put into practice. Think about outcomes that are important to the patient and think about what is your clinical message that you're trying to give through this, and how will it last in the memory? How is what you're saying going to last more than the time taken for the reader to read it?
These are the types of things that would be really interesting to do sort of on your mobile, wouldn't they, when you've got 5 minutes?
Yes.
Are they accessible in that format?
Yes, absolutely. So on the education practice website, what you can, or Archives of Disease and Childhood, if you want to look at the different groups of articles, you can actually just search for the group of articles and see what's been published. It would be fair to say that if Archives has recently accepted something on an area, they're unlikely to be able to take something for the next kind of 2 to 3 years unless it significantly changes practice there's some new evidence. Just because otherwise you're, you know, for example, congenital diaphragmatic hernia, you know, if you show an X-ray of congenital diaphragmatic hernia, it's not going to change terribly much in future patients in the next kind of 2 to 3 years. So it would be worth looking to see what's already been said on that subject. Other vehicles that are quite fun that you can talk about include Archimedes, which is basically an evidence-based review on a subject. For those people who are familiar with their best bets and you know, emergency pediatrics approach to an issue, basically what you would do is pose a clinical question in the PICO format, so patient intervention comparison outcome, and then do a quick and dirty look at the evidence base, say through Google Scholar. If your evidence review results in more than about 5 or 6 papers, then perhaps Archimedes isn't the format for it, and you need to do formal systematic review. But for those people who are kind of learning about doing evidence-based reviews, it's quite a fun format. If you run your review and then you put it in a table format, highlighting the salient points of the study plus also any critique of the evidence that you may have, for example, you know, funding, you know, issues about funding or issues about conflict of interest, and you can add your own comments on that, and then you have a clinical bottom line about the Archimedes and the evidence for example, using gas and air as an analgesia in phlebotomy, for example, or play therapy.
So if you're only sort of hoping to get about 5 or 6 articles or pieces of evidence, these sound like they'd be quite rare or quite sort of novel questions. Is that fair to say?
Yes. But they should be clinically very relevant. There are, you know, just because something's been written about well doesn't mean that it's that common and vice versa. I think we can all kind of think about how many articles, for example, on colic there have been in the past 5 years. I can't remember reading one at all, and yet it's a perennial problem for parents. So and those are the more succinct articles. Those are punchy. The analogy I used in the peer talk was about the Nature article on DNA by Watson and Crick. It was only a 800-word letter. If you think what you say deserves more words than the Watson and Crick article, then please go for a bigger format. But if you keep it punchy, you'll keep your learning gems much more. They stand out more, and they don't get lost within the extra text. That being said, there are some other formats within Archives of Disease and Childhood that are quite useful. So 15-minute consultations, which is run by Sam Bajati, is a really good format for common presentations that present to the paediatric outpatients. For example, my child's head is too big or too small, my child's stool pattern is too frequent or too, mm-hmm. or they've got constipation. Common clinical scenarios and giving you a approach in how to handle these within the 15-minute constraints of your outpatient's appointment. And as I was transitioning from a registrar to a consultant and trying to keep clinical problems to 15 minutes, I found that these articles were really useful to read to give me a landscape to help navigate my patients and parents through.
And those are all topics which come up quite a lot.
Yes.
Rather than being the weird and wonderful image.
Yes. It's, yes, this is much more bread and butter. How can I manage this? And you can bring in up-to-date evidence to help people understand, for example, novel tests in a certain area, and how to integrate them into your clinical conversation. If you have if you've come across a clinical test, however, that you are interested in, interpretations is quite a good section. So, for example, calprotectin. We did interpretations on calprotectin. So on calprotectin, you would start off with your title. You'd introduce where calprotectin is fitted in with clinical practice. You'd discuss the physiological concepts, and also the technological components of the test. You know, may be useful to talk about how the machine would analyze calprotectin, how to come, how the normal limits play into clinical practice. Definitely think about it from the patient's point of view. So when they collect the test, how long have they got to get it to the GP or to the hospital? Do they need to get it in within 2 hours, which would be the case for reducing substances, for example, or calprotectins, which can wait for 24, 48 hours and are much more stable and don't break down. Think about the indications, think about the limitations of a certain test, and that will again make the article a lot more readable. Think about what areas haven't been addressed by the current evidence and should be looked into, and then develop a clinical bottom line. What's your take-home point that you really want your reader to take away and to use in clinical practice? And then, just to consolidate understanding, we ask for 4 or 5 multiple choice questions just to embed learning and to make sure some of the key concepts have been taken home. And then probably the last topic, having said about conciseness and sticking to words, word limits, is something called problem solving in clinical practice. So for those people who like to tell a story, who like to lead people on a journey, this is about 3,000 to 5,000 words. You can have up to 30 references, and we'd ask for 5 multiple choice questions with it. You'd start off with a reasonably vague title, but that would be reasonably common, and take the reader on a journey through the child's clinical development, where you would go thinking the child has, you know, disease X, and actually they turn, you do test Y, and then you end up with conclusion Z. And you can talk about disease X in a bit of detail, you can talk about test Y in a bit of detail, and then talk about your conclusion on condition Z. It does need quite a bit of support, and it may need quite a bit of editorial input to help you shape that article, because it's a bit bigger, it will take a bit longer to do, and we would still ask for even though you've got more words, each area to be as concise, to be as interesting, and to be as challenging and as up to date as any of the other sections, be it images or epilogue or interpretations.
Okay, so that brings us on to the input of the editors. So what would I do? So if I want to do, let me see, one of these perhaps medium length type articles, I want, or interpretations. So
yes.
So I write my piece, and then how do I get it to an editor?
So even before you want to write your piece, what you might want to do is think about developing an sort of elevator pitch. So think about what you're trying to say and distill it down to one or two paragraphs. And then if you look on the archives website, particularly Education and Practice, there are the email addresses for the various editors in charge mm-hmm. of each section. So, for example, Bob Phillips in terms of Archimedes, Sam Pajati in terms of interpretations and the 15-minute consultations, myself in terms of images and epilogue, and also Lisa Brown, who's also recently joined editor Education and Practice to help out with epilogue as well, send an email off to us. Try and get us interested. If you get us interested in the topic, we are much more likely to be able to take it through all the way to publication. And then you know that you haven't wasted, you know, months on doing an article ready for submission and taking it through. The things that we'll be able to give you are guidance in terms of how your pitch would fit into the current landscape of what's out there medically and what's coming through the pipeline as well. We'll give you enthusiasm, we'll give you direction, and we will give you support. We like seeing our kind of trainees and colleagues taking things through to publication. And it's one thing that I think as Wessex, we want the publications to stand there along with the innovation, the education and the research in terms of what peer delivers.
So I hadn't realised that actually it's better to contact the editors first before embarking on this.
I think as part of your journey,
yeah.
you want somebody who can guide you through. Different editors will have their own style, so some people will be able to help you through each stage of the journey. We won't necessarily be part of the in-depth bouncing forwards of drafts backwards and forwards. We'll probably look at the pitch. We'll probably look at your first draft that you're ready to submit and say yes or no, or you need to do some tweaks, and be involved to be able to help steer it through. Once you get asked to submit it to Scholar One, it will then go through the formal peer review process. So in terms of submitting actually to a journal, that's quite an interesting journey. So if you get a reject within the first week, that's probably where it's hit the editor. The editor's looked at it and thought, this isn't right. They should usually give you some individual feedback on why it isn't right, you know, in terms of was it novel enough, or was there a problem with the style, or individual feedback that if you want, or whether it was right for the journal at all, or whether another journal would be more relevant. And that's quite a useful thing to go through. But once, if you don't hear anything for 2 to 3 weeks, that's probably quite a good thing because it's gone for peer review. So when it goes to peer review, we'll get people who have published on this area before or have an area of expertise, and they'll be able to critique your article. Again, it's with your your overall development in mind and being able to help the article. They will give the editors their view on whether it is suitable for publication or whether it will be suitable for publication with appropriate edits, or probably whether it isn't quite right for the journal. And then you'll get a couple of messages. You'll either get a reject. You get either a reject, resubmit, which is an opportunity to resubmit it. They'll either say things like, we think we may be able to accept a version of this in the future. And that's basically an opportunity to majorly revise the article or to shape the article a lot more. If the article looks really good and there's only one or two tweaks, then it'll come back as a minor revision.
Yeah.
It's incredibly rare to get a complete accept at first go. So please don't take that as a criticism. Frankly, us editors feel like we need to contribute something to the process, and we will, we'll just take the opportunity to kind of tweak a few things. So generally, that's how a paper should progress through. We aim to have the peer review back within 30 days and make a decision by 60 days. For articles that go to the main journal, once they've got peer review, they will often go through to an auction process where the editors sit down and they have a look at all the articles and again say, is it right for this journal, and have a second look at that paper. And that auction can be relatively an important part in the peer review in the peer review process, and then you get your decision after that.
And you made a really interesting point in your talk at the conference about your first submission being the most likely to succeed, which I think we all sort of found quite interesting.
Yeah, I think it should be your best shot at it. I wouldn't, submit something formally through Scholar One that still needed a significant amount of work doing. It's a lot harder to work with, and we'd also ask a few questions about the team that had supported you that allowed it to go through in that kind of format, if you see what I mean. So get it to your best go. There will be a time where you're editing something and it's as close to it as you can get, and that's at the point where you should send it in and see what other people think.
So if I'm all fired up to get something published now and I think, now I feel like I can do this, what do you think would be the best sort of first publication to go for?
It's a mixture of motive and opportunity. Mm. I think managing where you are and deciding, what's right for your stage in your training and what's right for your team is important. Similarly, it's what's around you that's important. If you have a consultant who's particularly interested in a publication or has recently had an interesting presentation, if you just make yourself known that you're interested in doing it, the work will beat its way to your door.
Okay.
So it's, but do bear in mind that all of this will be undertaken in your own time, and there will be quite a few evenings spent doing this. You'll be amazed how many other paediatricians are there at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night, just emailing each other and bashing drafts around the region. So you won't be on your own by any stretch of the imagination.
Just out of interest, in your role as editor, how much of your time do you spend on that type of work?
Editing? Again, so there's a little bit of what I'm doing to support trainees with articles, and I probably spend a couple of hours a week doing this. In terms of my archives work, that's probably a afternoon / evening a week, basically when my wife falls asleep on the sofa. Then my time is my own.
And do you also write your own articles, or are you mainly editing?
Yes. Yeah. No. So we've had been lucky enough to have four articles published in the past month, including one in the BMJ with Pip Thomas and Mark Beattie.
Oh, amazing. Tell us about that then.
So that was a opportunity to... that was an easily missed section for the BMJ. So the BMJ, in terms of its readership, you really have to think about primary care as 80% of its readership.
Okay.
So this was to help GPs be better at picking up children with celiac disease, helping them to understand that celiac disease is not just a severe form of wheat intolerance, it's an entirely different disease process, to chat about the differences in testing, so the fact that we can use TTG, IgA, anti-endomysial antibodies and HLA subtyping to diagnose children rather than waiting for endoscopy, and then to help GPs understand the importance of a gluten-free diet and why instituting a gluten-free diet early is important, to help growth and basically to help them look out for that big population of children out there who are a bit pale, have a bit of tummy pain, but the symptoms are really vague. Could it be celiac disease? Because it is easily missed.
Yeah. Great. Thanks so much, Mark.
An absolute pleasure. And thank you so much for asking me to be part of this.
Thank you.
So a big thank you once again to Mark Tye. I'm Caroline Story, and this was Fontenelle. I'm really looking forward to bringing you more of the material from the Peer Conference 2018. But until next time, from Fontenelle, goodbye.
Thank you.